First of all, let me thank you, Hannes, for doing the moderation. Until, I think, 2 days ago, we didn't have a moderator, so it's nice that you volunteer. Welcome to the first lightning talk of the 24th Chaos Communication Congress. My name is Oliver. I am one of the volunteers making the Congress Radio project. The Congress Radio project has quite a history on the Congress. Since the 19th Congress, we are doing a radio station, normally FM. So UKW in German. We started in the house am Kölnischen Park, and then when the Congress moved here, we moved also. We had several local radio stations at the last Congress, but 2 years ago, the media body of Berlin-Brandenburg, die Medienanstalt Berlin-Brandenburg, took away all the free license, FM license, or all the free frequencies. So we had no broadcast anymore. So we went to podcasting and to a distribution portal in the internet from the Federal Association of Free Radios in Germany. The internet address is freie-radios.net. You can find it in Google if you're looking for freeradios.net or stuff like that. Should be pop up soon. There we publish our podcasts or radio interviews, and other free radio stations can take these transmissions and use them in their own radio programs. And I'm here today because I want to ask you if somebody wants to join our team, if somebody wants to do interviews, if somebody wants to do podcasting or blogging, then you can call us. The DEC number is 1234. Yes, 1234 as count to four. And we are located in the C level, at the room C82. So it's on the side facing the shopping mall. So you always find somebody sitting there cutting audio files and stuff like that. The second lightning talk is should be about Gapminder. I wanted to show you, which is not working now, a website by a Swedish professor, Hans Rosling. I was introduced to Hans Rosling watching TED videos. TED is a conference in California every year. The 1,000 most important people are invited to this conference. And Hans Rosling is a Swedish professor of public health, and he invented the software to make statistical data visual. So statistical data is normally boring. It's Excel sheets, not very compelling, not very interesting. And he, with his student, developed a visualization software, which was acquired by Google in 2006. So you just go on gapminder.org, look for the Gapminder world chart, and you can see, which I cannot show now, is a new kind of presentation, and it will change your view, the view of the world. It's an interactive program that displays different statistical data from public-founded databases in a new dynamic way. You can see the world as it is today, look back in time, and watch countries develop using over 40 variables. And it's a very new map of the world. It's not a developed world against undeveloped world or developing countries. It's not west against east. It's not north against south. It makes the view of the world, which you have today, completely ridiculous and completely wrong. You can see different countries completely the other way as you did before. Each country is a circle on the chart, and instead of north and south, there's a level of health or globe or income or child mortality or child per woman. And instead of east and west, there's amount of money or gross income or stuff like that. And this is on the axis on the left, and the other is on the bottom. And each country is a circle on the chart, and the color of the country depends on the country's region. So Hans Rosling divided the countries in the two Americas, in sub-Saharan Africa, in North Sahara Africa, which means the Islamic countries of Africa, and the Arab states, Europe and Russia, South Asia and Asia. So they have different colors, red, blue, yellow and stuff like that. And if you click on the on the global map, then you see all the countries, all the blue, all the circles of the same color appear. So you can see them immediately. Or if you click on one circle, you see on the global map on the other side You can see on the global chart the continent, the place where the country is supposed to be. And the size of the circle depends on the population. So China is the most, the biggest circle on that chart. And countries like, I don't know, Sierra Leone or small countries, Andorra, they are almost invisible until you zoom in. The name of, on the, of the country appears when you point on the circle. Okay, just look at the website. You will find Gapminder there. It's based on the Trendalizer software, which was acquired by Google, as I said. How many, wie viel Zeit habe ich noch? Okay, the last 2 minutes, I will just mention Dollar Street. It's another software project by Hans Rosling and his team. I think it's, until now it's Windows-only software, so you have to install it on a Windows virtual machine or something like that. Nobody has Windows installed, I know. Dollar Street is a program where you see all people of the world live on one street, the Dollar Street. The poorest live on the left side and the richest live on the right side. Everybody else lives in between, these poor and the richest. Dollar Streets contains complete photo panoramas from households at different income levels. So students and people went to the world and took pictures of living rooms, toilets, kitchens and stuff like that of different income levels, of families of different income levels. And the current version includes 13 households and 3 school documentations from Mozambique, South Africa and Uganda. And you scroll on the Dollar Street, on the software, from the left to the right, move up and down so you can pan into the pictures. And you can select, I mean, the people of IKEA asked the professor, show us the sofas because we sell sofas. So he showed them the sofas of different income level, so $1 a day, $10 a day, $50 a day. So how the income develops. And yeah, try that. Try Dollar Street, try Gapminder. And if you want to join the Congress Radio team, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Oliver. So the next would be Matt Edman. Is he around? No? Okay, then maybe Sunday. Then Mathis Manzel. Is he around?
Just arrived.
Oh, just arrived. So we will do that not now, but in 5 minutes. So Serna, free geodata. Yeah. Welcome, Serna, about free geodata and geoprojects. This talk is in German. Einfach rüberziehen.
Links, rechts.
Ich habe einen USB-Sticks with your slides.
Brauche ich doch mal eine Adresse aufrufen.
Internet habe ich da vorne gerade nicht.
Ach, ja. Browser,
ne? Nein, ich habe da.
Ich
habe da gerade einen.
Zeig mal. Das ist echt sehr schade. Ich brauche einen Vollscreen.
Hm?
Brauche einen Vollscreen. Ah, ich kann meistens.
Control L.
Ah.
Also Apfel L.
Nee.
Control.
Ich mache einfach Mais so ohne Vollscreen. So. Okay, freie Geodaten auf Deutsch.
Mikrofon.
Oh, okay. Ja, es bringt aber nichts, weil dann zeigt es nur hier an. Ich brauche es, aber ich meist so. Genau. So.
Also ich habe da vorne gerade kein Internet.
Okay.
Das ist das Problem.
Könnt ihr es nicht einfach
so? Nee, das ist meine Rechner.
Würde auch gehen, aber egal, mach mal so. Also, freie Geodaten.
Nein, ich habe da kein Internet.
Die ganzen Links hier drin, es wird eine kleine Übersicht. Die ganzen Links sollten alle hier auf der Wiki-Seite stehen. Im Wiki unter freie Geodaten. Hier ein kleiner Screenshot. Hauptsächlich, ich komme aus OpenStreetMap. Projekt und es geht aber hier nicht um OpenStreetMap. Sieht übrigens so aus. Sondern Und die haben auch nicht den Editor, nennt sich JOSM, sieht so aus, sondern es geht eigentlich mehr um die Informationsquellen. Wer was über OpenStreetMap wissen möchte, morgen, Saal 3, 21:45, Frederik, der diesen JOSM-Editor maintained, hält einen Vortrag drüber. Es gibt dann ein anderes Projekt, das nennt sich Open Aerial Map, ist im Prinzip dasselbe wie OpenStreetMap, nur halt mit Bilder. Das heißt, jeder kann Bilder hochladen, oder wenn zum Beispiel jemand so eine Microdrone oder sowas hat und irgendein Skript hat, das dann irgendwie eine Stätte automatisch abfliegt und ein Bild draus macht, kann das hier hochladen und wird dann auch wieder mit den OpenStreetMap-Daten kombiniert, und dann haben wir hier auch sowas wie Google Maps, nur halt frei, und jeder kann es verwenden, wie ihr möchtet. Außerdem gibt's geonames.org, die haben einfach ganz viele Geodaten, was es hier so gibt, zusammengefasst und in eine schöne GUI reingeschmissen und eine schöne API, eine schöne GUI dazu baut. Man kann hier alles bearbeiten, JavaScript-mäßig, also im Prinzip wirklich für Geodaten, basiert halt auf Google Maps, was dann auch wieder Probleme bringt mit, okay, wenn ich jetzt die Layer einblende, dann kann ich ja einfach die Marker so hinsetzen und kopiere sozusagen fast wieder das Zeug von Google Maps, aber das ist ein schwieriges Thema. Weil wir schon dabei waren, Google Maps, gibt es natürlich auch eine API, Ganze gibt es natürlich auch im Frei, nennt sich dann Open Layers, die sind eigentlich unabhängig vom Open OpenStreetMap Projekt, aber wird halt von denen benutzt. Ganz wichtig, die Doku anschauen, wenn man sich damit beschäftigt, und vor allem die Beispiele, die sind nicht so gut verlinkt, da wird schon sehr viel erklärt drin, die Links dazu alle auf der Wiki-Seite. Dann eine große Quelle sind dann noch Geodaten aus den USA, weil es gibt ja da irgendwie so, vom Copyright-Gesetz her, ist es so, dass Geodaten, was alles von Bundesmitarbeitern erfasst wird, muss frei sein. Sind zum Beispiel die SRTM-Daten, es gibt auch ganz viele auch Luftbilder, wo ich frei verfügbar bin. Die SRTM-Daten sind Höhendaten, hier gibt es eine schöne Demo dazu. Und hier zum Beispiel Tiger-Daten, Straßen, die werden dann importiert, zum Beispiel momentan in OpenStreetMap. Sieht momentan so aus, man sieht, imported, nicht importiert. Dann gibt es Webmap-Services, das bieten unter anderem, also im Prinzip funktioniert es wie über HTTP. Man kann sich zum Beispiel anzeigen, was bietet alles an. Dann hier kann man so einen Teil abfragen, sieht man ja, man gibt im Prinzip an, wie groß soll das Ding sein, also 300 mal 300 Pixel, welche Projektion. Das ist ein ganzes Thema, kommen wir jetzt mal dazu. Und hier unten gibt man dann an, in welchen Koordinaten, also links oben, rechts unten und welches Format. Und dann bekommt man einfach über HTTP ein Bild. Und das gibt's halt dann von den Vermessungsämtern zum Beispiel. Wenn man sich die Konfigurationsdatei mal anschaut, sieht man hier jedes Bundesland ein. Und die kann man eigentlich mit jeder Software, was man so hat, was WMS kann, abrufen. Problem sind dann nur noch die Produktionen. Okay, das wäre es einfach. Falls jemand Fragen hat, anrufen, E-Mail schreiben, Jabber. Dankeschön.
Willst du jetzt einen Vortrag halten ohne Internet, oder willst du es noch schnell auf den USB-Stick kopieren, irgendwas? Und das anzeigen? Sag. Ja, nein? Okay. Okay, the next is Mattes Menzel about Wikinets.
Unfortunately, I can show no web pages, so I have to talk like that. There are 29 wiki hives. A wiki hive means you can create a new wiki with a click. No silly questions like, what is your wiki about? And I made a wiki, the hive wiki, gathering all these different wiki hives. Cool. The communication among these wiki hives and the wiki sitting in them is painfully poor. Mostly they don't even know about each other. That's not cool, nor wiki. For connecting wiki communities, it would take certain interfaces to the public for each wiki, I thought. These should put out RSS feeds, so every wiki can include interface pages of neighboring wikis locally. For example, wikis should have a face telling about what's going on in the community. The page Wikinet Faces, as its counterpart, shows the faces of wikis in the neighborhood and the local face of the wiki. Every wiki community chooses its own neighborhood. That's very important. I made up several such interfaces to the public, starting with single wikis, then gathering wikis of a certain context in center wikis. Recently, I connected some wiki hives, wiki hosting places. The wiki hive lists of a wiki hive lists all living wikis in it. The page wikinet hive lists lists all the wikis in the neighboring wiki hives. Sorry, I can't show anything. I wish it would be easy for a wiki community to connect to other communities, having information about them locally and updated automatically. That's the idea behind it. All it takes is each community to care for its face and a couple of other local pages for communicating to the public. I even wish it would be easy for a wiki to move physically closer to its neighborhood by migrating to another more adequate wiki hive and thus enabling the conglomeration of collective intelligence. Wikis are nomads. That's an important sentence there. A center wiki is a common platform for a certain type of wiki. For example, all wikis in a wiki hive using Germans are gathered in a Wikizentrum for the wiki hive. But center wikis gathering wikis from different wikis hives are just as well possible. For example, a city wiki center or a political wiki center. Each wiki has a homepage in the center wiki, including basic information about it, and including the recent changes on the bottom of the wiki. The center wiki runs a wiki list linking to the homepages of the single wikis. And when a wiki has a homepage in the wiki center, the wiki list of the center wiki is included into the wiki node of the wiki. That results in a local and automatically updating list of likely neighboring wikis. And it is only one, in words one, click to see each wiki's recent changes on the bottom of the homepage. I think it's a little sad to see to see competitiveness among different wiki hives, which all hosts wikis, which are basically collaborative. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks. The next talk is by Ricardo Christoph Remenfortes about AK Forward and on the go current projects and plans. Schließt er nicht an, der hat da nur Notizen drauf.
Oh, wrong password, sorry. Well, hi, I'm Christoph from the AK Vorrat, the German working group on data retention. We have a desk right here at the corner near the FFII desk where you see the big transparent with Mr. Schäuble on it. I would like to talk about the next goals, the next projects we will do. Maybe you heard we are filing a constitutional complaint against the data retention law, which will be adopted in January the 1st. We will find this complaint within the next days. We have reached about, well, between 25,000, 30,000 participants with this complaint, which is an absolute world record. We plan to do a press conference on Saturday. We have to think about that and to work about that, but we plan to do it here on the Congress. And that's for experts. If you want to join the press team, please come to our desk. But there are other projects and other topics, other tasks we have to do. The next is the demonstration in Hamburg on December the 31st. If you come from Hamburg, please join us. Please come to our informational desk. We will give you the information where to find it. We hope to see some thousand people there. Then there will be a demonstration in Munich at January the 6th, and should be also very large. If you come from Bavaria, please join it. But we have a lot of work to do. The constitutional complaint is not the end of our race, not the end of our work. We will therefore invite to a strategy congress during February the 8th to February the 10th, which will be held in Kassel. We will invite all NGOs dealing with privacy, human rights, civil rights, also the parties, of course, and the activists throughout Germany. If you want to join, please come to our informational desk. The goal of this strategy congress is mainly, developing strategies for getting into the stakeholders groups, forcing strategies of lobbying, civil society lobbying, civil rights lobbying, and force the networking of the civil society in general. So that's a very important thing we have to work about, because the problem at present is that a lot of NGOs are working separately, they are not connected very good. Well, we plan, of course, the next large demonstration in Germany. We do not have a date for that, but it will be about, I hope 50,000 participants. It depends on you. We need more activists, we need volunteers, we need people who work and spare some time, some hours a month, to bring this movement further. If you want to join us, please come to our informational desk, and we have also a DECT, which is 2584. We will be here and we will answer your questions. Thank you very much.
The next talk is number 32. It's done by Fubats about EU telecom pages. He has only time today, and he is...
I keep it very short. We have kein Netz hier?
Doch, mittlerweile schon.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm based in Brussels. I'm working on many EU projects, especially in the area of open standards right now. And I also was involved in data retention, and we know that this data retention movement is now very big in Germany. We have demonstrations, we have the constitutional complaint here in Germany, which I find very interesting, but I have no time to deal with it anymore. But in Brussels, it was like 10 people working half-time on the project, and we just lacked people in Brussels working on it with Parliament and so on. So I came across something. I think we can reverse or at least change the direction of the data retention directive by a current project, and this is the Generaldirektion Informationsgesellschaft, DG InfoSoc, Directorat General. They proposed a telecom package, telecommunication regulation. It's three directives, and these three directives are extremely obfuscated and change several other directives. So nobody really knows and understands these directives, and they create a new telecom regulation authority that should be independent from politics. And what I found out is, just by analyzing the telecom directive, just a bit, I don't have much time for it, that this one of these directives changes the same directive that was changed by the data retention directive, which was also a directive that changed another directive. So this directive now is a channel to reverse the effects of the data retention directive, and we can use it. Just someone needs to work on it, provide a consolidated version what actually this directive does. I created a wiki page. I can invite you to this wiki page. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So this is the web address where I put it. It's telcompackage.wiki.com, and there I assembled all the different directives. What directives will get amended by this especially very obfuscated piece of legislation. What I need are people who are interested to work on it, to analyze it, to find out what it really does, what are the pitfalls, and provide some input for parliamentarians. And I'm pretty sure that MEPs, members of the parliament, will be extremely helpful, extremely amazed if you provide input to them, because they will hate this telecom package because it's so obfuscated and nobody really knows what it does, and their assistants also need to work on it. There are no rapporteurs assigned yet, people in the parliament committee that are responsible for it, but each of these directives will go to about six committees. So you really have an opportunity, if you really want a change get applied, you try it in each of these committees. You just need one MEP to table your change proposal, and maybe it gets accepted by the one committee, maybe by the other, and then some other members of the committee will provide their own change proposals. So I think it's an extremely interesting opportunity, and there are also some other pitfalls probably in this directive. I think in this directive package, I think it's pretty evil and we don't understand it yet. So we need your help to analyze it. And yeah, or maybe if you have a sponsor, I can employ some guys who work on it. Yeah, so thank you.
Okay, thanks. The next talk is by Thomas Rössler. Rössler, about when witches go bad.
Hello. Can you hear me? Hello, I'm Thomas. I'm an Apple user. I would like to introduce you to a species of software that I believe... Hello? Oh, please. What's this? How do I move on to the next slide? Very well, thank you. No,
sorry.
Okay, you can add that to my time. I would like to introduce you to a species of software that you haven't paid enough attention to, and indeed we will go out of this. Chris Leopard. I want to introduce you to a species of software that you haven't paid a lot of attention to, and that's all these nifty little widgets running in the Apple dashboard. A widget is a little helper. It's a little helper that often provides an interface to some Web 2.0 website. By definition, it is therefore cool. It is also very easy to install, just one click. In particular, if you're using Safari, it all feels safe. It's easy to install. It's easy to program this stuff because you actually all know the programming environment that these beasts live in. That programming environment is HTML and CSS for the user interface, and it is JavaScript for the behavior. Well, it's almost the environment you know from the web because widgets have a little bit of additional power. For example, you have a widget.system method, which is indeed precisely the same thing as system 3 on a traditional Unix C library. Or you can go out to the network, but without that pesky same origin policy. Speaking of going out to the network, I said a widget is often a front end for a Web 2.0 application. That means it needs to access some application's API. Cool APIs these days are built on top of JSON, the JavaScript object notation. That means you're sending JavaScript constant expressions over the wire, and as everything with widgets, these are easy to parse. Let me repeat that. You go out on the network with HTTP, you retrieve data. The data is code. You feed the code to eval in an environment where you have access to a system shell. I'm not even giving you the list of widgets that do that. There's many of them. But that's actually boring. The interface is HTML-based. That means that if a widget takes data from the network and wants to tell you about these data, it needs to write that information to the document object model. Writing strings to the DOM and being sloppy about it is what we know as cross-site scripting vulnerabilities on websites. Well, no longer on websites. This is the Google Mail front end for the dashboard, they recently released a new version. What this beast did was it wrote stuff to the user interface by overwriting the inner HTML property. So you can put tags in there and all that funny stuff. And well, the stuff they wrote there came from an email's subject header. This was enough to execute a shell on the affected computer. In short, widgets are easy to install. They're very easy to program. They include security critical code in JavaScript, and they include tons of security critical bugs, which are incredibly easy to exploit. Pay attention to them, enjoy them. If you want to talk more about it, see me in the break. Thank you.
Okay, the next talk is about OpenXP PKA update.
Okay, hi everybody, I'm Alech. I work at Synops, a small network security company outside of Frankfurt. And I'd like to talk a bit about OpenXPKI again. OpenXPKI is a PKI or Trust Center software project. It's not the typical PKI project that you have in the open source community, because most of them are for the home installations. So that's a bit more business-like. When I say business, well, that's what we learned from working in a PKI project in a large financial institution. So basically the requirements come from there, talk to a lot of backend systems and so on. It's mostly written in Perl, has some C code to glue to OpenSSL. Basically there's an abstraction from the cryptographic library, so if you don't like OpenSSL, you can replace that. And of course it is free software, it comes under an Apache license, and for the details you can see the talk that I gave at 23C3 about it. So all the details are in there. What I want to talk today about is a bit what we did in 2007, so since the last time I talked about it. One thing we did pretty early in the year was we added support for Request Tracker. For those of you who don't know Request Tracker, it's a ticketing system, also written in Perl, and it's pretty useful if you've got a large business environment where if you've got lots of request supports regarding the certificate requests, then you can just do them using Request Tracker, and Request Tracker send out your email saying, your certificate is ready, you can download it here and there, and you don't have to do that manually anymore. So that's pretty useful. What we also did was implement approval with digital signatures. That's pretty neat. You can use your browser and approve the certificate requests using digital signatures. That both works on Mozilla-based browsers and on IE as well. Also pretty nice if you've got lots of users who don't exactly care about certificates, they just want their application to work, is what we call a template-based certificate subject generation. That's basically the idea. Normally, your PKI application asks your user, okay, what subject of your certificate would you like to have? And then the user goes like, subject? Well, what was that again? And how is it supposed to look like? And the idea is that you ask the user the information that he knows. Like, you ask, okay, you've got that, you want to have that application for a TLS server. What is the host name of the server? What is the port of the server? And then the user inputs that data, and you create your certificate subject based on a templating system. And that's pretty useful, because then users don't mess up your certificate naming conventions. What we also did was introduce a configuration versioning. So we've got something called workflows that start at some time, and then they run, and at some time they are finished. And if you want to change the configuration in between, that's pretty tricky, because it might change the way your workflow is actually running. Think of the workflow as a state machine. So you can't exactly do that when there are workflows in progress. So what we did is the workflows start with their configuration, and they run with the configuration they started with. And at any time, if you change the configuration, it's only valid for the new workflows that are created, which is a pretty neat thing, I think, as well. So you can keep your system running and update the configuration, and it only affects the things that you create newly on the system. We recently also released a first live CD version because the installation depends on, well, half of CPAN probably. So it's a bit of a dependency hell to actually install OpenX PKI. So if you want to give it a quick test ride, you can use the live CD for that. That's pretty nice. And if you don't care about PKI, well, something you could look into as well is Morphix. I was pretty amazed how easy it is to create live CDs using Morphix. That's pretty neat. You can build Debian-based live CDs just using an XML configuration file and one command, say, okay, give me an ISO. That's pretty cool. And what will be new in 2008? Well, we're planning to create a new live CD, or that is actually nearly finished, just not uploaded yet. It will come with a persistent storage support, so you can actually run your small PKI. I wouldn't recommend that for a real productive environment, but for trying it out at home or for running your home PKI, you can do that from the CD. Just use a USB stick as the medium for your CA key and your database that will be on the CD, and you can do that pretty much from the OpenX PKI Live CD, which will be released in early January. We will hopefully have a stable release sometime soon. We'll have more documentation. That's a promise. Hold me to that. And we'll have some more productive installations. We've got some customers who want to switch over from OpenCA, which is the predecessor project. If you want to talk about OpenX PKI or PKI in general, I'm very happy to do that. Talk to me when you see me. I'm Alech. Unluckily, I forgot my deck at home, so you will have to email me if you want to catch me. Our webpage is openxpki.org, and those two are the mailing list where the communication regarding the project takes place. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. The next one is Serna again with Wikipedia Projekt Vorlagenauswertung. Yeah, you're 12.
Yeah, I'm 12. Somebody just got interested. Somebody got it before, so it was. Yeah.
Yeah. He told me that he only has time today.
There's nothing on the wiki about which day.
Yeah.
Okay. Also, dieses Mal über Wikipedia-Projekt Vorlagenauswertung. Es kommt daher, es gibt ja in Wikipedia. Es gibt ja in Wikipedia diese Vorlagen, die man recht leicht einbinden kann, zum Beispiel bei Tieren, Elefanten, Städten, einfach um Informationen, die es bei jedem Artikel irgendwie aus einer Gruppe gibt, geordnet darzustellen. Wie gesagt, hier beim Elefanten. Und das Wikipedia-Projekt Vorlagenauswertung kommt daher, es gab so ein Template, mit dem man hier Koordinaten einbinden konnte. Und da hat sich jemand gedacht, okay, das kann man doch mit Google Earth, Google Maps oder so auch noch ein bisschen schön auf einer Karte darstellen oder so. Und hat dann ein Perl-Script oder sowas geschrieben, das die ganzen Dinge, das einfach einen Dump nimmt und diese Koordinaten rausholt und in eine Datenbank schmeißt. Dürfte ja mal einigen bekannt sein. Und dann haben sie es noch ein bisschen erweitert, dass es eben mit allen Vorlagen geht. Das heißt, man kann dann zum Beispiel für Personen, alle Personen, die mit so und so anfangen, bitte auflisten. Oder meinetwegen, der da geboren ist und dann gestorben ist, der soll jetzt auf der Liste aufstellen. Wie man sieht, ist momentan recht langsam, hat den Sinn, weil das Ganze alles in einer Datenbank drin steckt. Das heißt, das hier ist jeweils ein Datenbankeinsatz, bei dem nicht einmal IDs verwendet werden, sondern einfach Namen, Strings. Das heißt, wie oft da Vorlage Personendaten drin steht, kann man sich ja ausdenken. Und Ziel, was ich jetzt ein bisschen bewirken will, oder dass sich das ein paar Leute anschauen und vielleicht auch Lust haben, das ein bisschen zu optimieren. Zum einen Beispiel wäre, dass man also extra Tabellen macht mit IDs. Man kann sich das auch, es fand auch schon ein bisschen Diskussion statt. Also wer möchte, kann sich das mal durchlesen. Und man kann dann auch solche Sachen wie zum Beispiel einfache Queries direkt umbauen in die komplizierteren. Also Beispiel wäre jetzt hier. Wie viel Zeit habe ich noch? Das war jetzt so schnell.
Oder anderthalb.
Ja, okay. Dann zeige ich noch schnell das Tabellenlayout. Also das sind die Tabellen, was es momentan gibt. Beziehungsweise, nee. Hier. Man sieht einfach überall Strings. Und dass es langsam ist, ist klar. Und die Idee dahinter, das umzusetzen, wäre dann zum Beispiel hier, dass man einfach mit IDs baut. Und das dann alles schön miteinander ableitet und dann zum Beispiel auch solche Dinge macht, wie wenn ich sage, okay, Select Name, Geburtsdatum, From Person, Like Name, also alles, was mit And anfängt, das dann irgendwie in das die komplizierte Variante umbaut und das Ganze auch für End-User, beziehungsweise einfach Leute, die sich mit SQL ein bisschen auskennen, zugänglich macht und nicht die komplizierten Queries, wie man sie gerade oben dran stehen hatten, braucht und dann auch schöne Abfragen machen kann. Das wäre es eigentlich soweit.
Okay, the next speaker is Julian Todd about undemocracy.com. Yeah.
It'll show up, yes. Hello? Okay. I want to know what to speak about. Yeah. Oh, no.
Damn.
Shit. I have a PDF version there. You can grab it.
Yeah. Okay. So, Ricardo? Around? Can you just jump in about Tor? Cool. So we need to copy a PDF version of it.
Thank you. Hi, folks. Seems like I've been here before. Thanks. I will take it in my hands. Thank you. Oh, well, I was just chatting around. Sorry, I have to find my notes. There. Okay, I would like to talk about Tor. Well, actually, I'm not a technician. I do not know anything about the techniques behind it. But I believe that Tor is a way providing privacy to the masses, providing privacy for political activists, not only in Germany or Europe, but also in the third world. And therefore, I believe that the Tor network is a very important network, and we have to support it. That's why several people thought about bringing different ideas together. And this idea is contained, not excluding, but building up a network of NGOs and foundations running Tor servers, Tor exit nodes, to catch the liability issues which we have in Germany. In Germany, the running of Tor servers may be, the admins of Tor servers may be forced to store data, telecommunications data, when the data retention law gets into effect. So we try to build up foundations who, well, technically run the Tor servers and catch the liability issue. The other idea I heard about that Roger Dingeldein, who is here, I would like to meet you the next hours, was thinking about a kind of Tor web of trust. So excluding all the NSA-driven and CIA-driven Tor nodes, build up a Tor web of trust. That's a good idea, I think. Then there's another issue which is very important for Tor admins. It is building up a network of NGOs and foundations providing legal aid for Tor admins in Germany and Europe. Yesterday, we founded a new foundation about that, and we will try to provide legal aid for Tor server admins. Then there's another project which is a little bit technical. Maybe it's more interesting for you. We try to develop the guys from Freifunk, which you can find upstairs, try to develop an interface, an easy-to-use interface for dummies running Tor as an exit node on their wireless LAN router, which will contain only 5 options. Which is Tor on and off, wireless LAN on and off, and expert options. Usually the dummy just needs the 4 options on and off. Yeah. So, and there's a long running goal which will not be reached within the next days or weeks, but we try to develop some kind of pre-configured wireless LAN router, which should be very cheap and very easy to use for dummies. We try to build that together with the Freifunk community, and we will try to compete Phonera with that. If you would like to join that, if you have technical abilities, please come to the informational desk of the AKA Vorrat right at the corner, or to the Freifunk community on level C. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. So now we have Julian Todd on about undemocracy.com. Yeah. Hopefully.
Slideshow up top. Okay, the UN stands for United Nations, and 3 years ago I hacked the United Kingdom Parliament, and this year I've been hacking the United Nations to see what documents I can pull out of there. Now, United Nations was set up to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, and here we are 3 generations later and we've got a war, and it didn't save us from it, and the United Nations has a website for Iraq, and doesn't tell us how it didn't save us from the war, because it doesn't go for before 2003. Now, if you know exactly where to look, you can, and I'd buy a beer for anyone who can find this document, this one, Security Council Resolution 1441, which was in 2002, if anyone remembers this. If you do find this, you won't be able to show anyone else, because the URL that they link to you doesn't work for you. It has referring blocks, and the URL is randomized. So I can find it, but no one else can find it. So the solution is you first download every document you can find on it and rehost it under a proper URL, where you put it on your own website and you give it the correct URL with something that matches the document ID, S for Security Council Resolution 1441. And then you can read how the war began. So this is what one of those meetings looks like in the Security Council, and what I was showing was one of their judgments, their international law from it. Next door to this room, they have this other strange room where they also have meetings where all the countries speak and they all vote and no one ever finds out what they are because the transcripts are also hidden from you unless you really know where to look. So this is what one of the transcripts looks like. They speak, and occasionally your country will speak, and you might find out what's happening then. But this is a PDF file, so there's not much you can do with it, except you can convert it into XY coordinates for each word, and if you do a lot of work, you can recreate this into structured HTML and put this into a database or a front-end website, which is much easier to read. You can search, you can link to it. So for example, because they block the documents, you'll never find a United Nations document on Google if you use that search engine, and their search engine doesn't work. This is a short debate they had a few years ago about a war that ended in 1982. They have all kinds of jokes if you ever find out. This was the front page of the website that I was producing, which has recent meetings from Security Council. Now it's got the one from Benazir Bhutto. There was a meeting just yesterday, and it's already been parsed and processed. Then there's a General Assembly, which no one knows about. And finally, I've been putting links from Wikipedia articles into these formerly unreferenceable, unlinkable documents, which you can see going through there. Now, this is, for example, one such article where this Polish general got hurt in a bomb a few months ago, and there was a Security Council meeting about it, and so we can link to it, and you can read the meeting. There are a lot of important things that they don't have a meeting about. For example, they'll never meet about Fallujah or any more important issues. Okay, but the problem is that there hasn't been enough interest in it. The difficult problem of the PDF to structured HTML is done, and I would like anyone else who could take over the website and take all the credit if they want to. That's no problem. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. The last talk will be by Tomasz Wigranowski about cross-site scripting protection for Ruby on Rails.
Oh, well. Forget. Oops. Okay, basically Ruby on Rails is the most popular framework for Web 2.0, and the biggest problem with it is that it wasn't written with security in mind. So basically you have to take care of security when you're coding Rails. And one particularly nasty problem is that in Ruby on Rails views, it's very easy to make a silly mistake that will end up with your application being vulnerable to cross-site scripting requests. Vulnerabilities. Basically, every single string ever in any view, and in application there are usually more view code lines than normal code lines, if you miss any H, you end up with a potential vulnerability. And it's very, very easy. So I think that every single Rails application ever has this kind of vulnerabilities. So we developed a very simple plugin which pretty much deals with all of them, fixes all of them. And this doesn't only apply to RHTML. If you use an alternative template engine like, let's say, Haml, you still have the identical problem. So it's not about RHTML, it's about Ruby on Rails views in general. Okay. Basically, the problem is that you cannot escape everything. You must escape some things, those that are shown in red, and you must not escape things that are shown in blue because they generate HTML code. So if you have like link 2, then you must not escape it. On the other hand, when you have like things in red that are not HTML, you must escape it. So it's very easy to make a mistake. but there's a pattern where which things should be escaped and which should be not. So if something is a normal string, it in 99% of cases should be escaped. On the other hand, if something is an output of a helper like linkdo, in, well, 100% of cases, it should not be escaped. And this pattern is actually so simple that a simple plugin can handle all your XSS problems. Oops. Fuck. I hate Max. I really, really hate Max. Okay. Basically, the idea is to have two classes, the normal string that is shown in red here, and the safe string, which is a subclass of string, which is shown in green. And when in a view you have a red string, it will be automatically escaped, and if you have a green string, it will not be escaped. And basically, everything will handle the colors correctly. So we have basic operations like h, which does HTML escaping. And if you explicitly HTML escape something, it will, of course, will be green then, and it won't be escaped again. You have a magic method to S XSS protected, which is called by the view engine, which if something is red, it will be escaped. If something is green, it will be just kept like it was. And if something is not a string, it will be converted to a string and then HTML escaped. So this is what the view engine uses. And there's a third method which actually marks something explicitly as XSS protected. And this is used by helpers to mark their outputs as green, so it won't be escaped. So just providing the plugin with a list of helpers that you trust and handling the few special cases where you generate HTML manually by a few margas XSS protected and age and so on. So by very, very little code, you completely get rid of all XSS problems in your Ruby on Rails applications. So all your views are completely safe. You do not have to worry about XSS when you're doing views. You have to worry about XSS when you're doing helpers, but this is just like 100 times less code than all the views. And this is available on Google Code since last week, and I think this is a really, really great plugin.
Yeah, thanks a lot to all the speakers and all the public. So see you on Sunday for the other session of Lightning Talks. If you are interested to give a Lightning Talk, just add it to the wiki.